Dr. Hoffman here. This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Super Beets. I personally take Super Beets when I need a power boost. It's my favorite product. Super Beets gives me energy and stamina for my busy day. Right now, get a one-month supply free with your first order. Check out the Dr. Hoffman special right now at IntelligentBeets.com. That's IntelligentBeets.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk to one of the real celebrities in the field of complementary alternative medicine, someone who is very influential for me personally in launching my career in complementary and alternative medicine. He's been on the scene for a long time, and he also has really advanced a paradigm that at first seemed, seemed a little bit of an outlier. In a time when vegetarian diets were the vogue, he called for a diet that was higher in protein and healthier fats. He is, of course, none other than Barry Sears, the author of the best-selling book, The Zone Diet, and he's written numerous books since then, and he has a brand new book which thoroughly updates his theories in relationship to the zone. It's entitled The Mediterranean Zone, and we thought we'd invite Dr. Sears back on to tell us how his theories have weathered the test of time. Pretty well, I would say. So welcome, Dr. Sears, back on the program.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. So what prompted you to write The Mediterranean Zone? Because there's a lot of new information there. And, so we are basically reiterating the idea that a lower carb diet is more beneficial than the ultra high carb, low fat, low meat diet that was advocated for so long. But you've got some new ideas in the Mediterranean Zone.
Well, in many ways, the Mediterranean Zone is the completion of the trilogy, that I set out some 30 years to put together, all talking about anti-inflammatory nutrition. The first book of that trilogy was A Zone, which laid out the role of diet to basically control these inflammatory responses, followed by the Omega-RX Zone that talked about the role of high-dose omega-3 fatty acids to also reduce inflammation. And really, the third book of the trilogy is the Mediterranean Zone, because it now speaks to the role of a group of chemicals called polyphenols, which also have a very strong anti-inflammatory role.
Polyphenols may have been the missing element in the equation that we didn't know that much about. I mean, we had a notion when you first wrote The Zone way back in. When did The Zone first come out? In the early 90s?
That was 1995, and at that time, virtually no one knew anything about polyphenols, so it was really a totally unexplored world. But
indeed,
since that time, we've had a lot of new information. That's what the Mediterranean Zone brings to the reader.
Okay. So, how do you feel today? It's now 2014. It's almost 20 years later. Do you feel vindicated by the progress that science is making and newer studies on nutrition that are coming to the fore? I think you should feel pretty good because you called it. And
I really do. I have to admit that, in the early days, back in the mid-90s, it was basically a very lonely field out there, taking brickbats and arrows. But that's usually how you tell pioneers. The more arrows they have in the back, the closer they are to getting to where you want to be. But it's been a very fascinating journey to understand the linkage between the foods we eat and how they can either increase or decrease inflammation. And the beauty of the story, it keeps expanding as we get more and more sophistication of understanding how powerful diet is in terms of controlling the expression of our genes.
So let's go back to basics. I mean, lay out the theory of the zone for those who are not acquainted with it.
Well, the theory is actually quite simple, at least in theory, and that is your goal is to keep certain hormones that are driven by the diet, within a zone. A zone is not too high, but not too low. And the reason for doing that is to control their inflammatory responses. And this requires basically treating the balance of protein, the carbohydrate, the fat at each meal like a drug. You take it at the right dosage, you take it at the right time. At the time when I wrote the book, I had a lot of theoretical aspects to confirm this, but it really became the next 20 years of one study after another in humans confirming what I thought out would be the appropriate diet to keep inflammation under control for a lifetime.
And so explain in a little greater depth how the food can be, now you make a point of this, I think you're one of the first to bring this to the fore for the public, because I think your genius is in bringing these very complex subjects to the fore in a way that they can be popularized and understood by the general public. We now know that there are cytokines and that hormones act as actually foods may act as messengers in terms of our metabolism.
Exactly. And probably the best analogy would be you think of our body as a very, very complex cell phone. Cell phones are great when they work. When they don't work, they're a piece of junk. And that's what happens when inflammation gets thrown into the mix. Our hormones are like the radio waves that are picked up by our cell phones. They convey information at great distances and of great fidelity. But if your diet is one that's causing more inflammation, and that is the release of certain agents like the cytokines you mentioned, then that causes a garbling of the communication. And when that garbling comes static, and with that static comes now the more rapid development of chronic disease. And that's why in many ways you can view virtually every chronic disease we can think of as really a disease that its primary starting point is increased inflammation in that particular organ. And the inflammation doesn't come from an injury or from a microbial infection, but it comes from the food we eat.
Well, so what is inherently wrong about the standard American diet? That is, we talk about anti-inflammatory diets and pro-inflammatory diets. You know, why don't we start with characterizing the perfect pro-inflammatory diet? What if you want to develop a lot of inflammation in your body? What should you do?
Two things: you want to eat a lot of white carbohydrates. That will increase the levels of glucose in the body, and that brings out more of the hormone insulin. For so long, insulin's been viewed as the bad boy of nutrition. It's the critical player. We have to have some insulin, but we need to keep it in the zone. Where insulin becomes really basically an evil bystander is when its fellow partner, omega-6 fatty acids, appear on the scene. And that's happening in great droves in the last 40 years in the American diet.
Well, I just checked the American Heart Association webpage, and under the diet section, they still say, and this is incredible to me because they're responsible for messaging to tens of millions of Americans. They're the go-to organization for heart disease prevention. They still say, reduce your intake of high-fat dairy foods and instead substitute vegetable oils. They're saying basically use margarine-like substances instead of butter. Butter being this evil thing that attacks your arteries, and the vegetable oils, which are precisely the omega-6 oils that you finger as culprits, they say slather those on.
Exactly. It's as if they're living in the 20th century, where we're living in the 21st century. You know, the data is pretty clear that these omega-6 fatty acids, we need some levels of amount. That's why they're called essential fatty acids.
Right.
But the amounts we're getting today in the American diet are incredibly higher than ever before in human history. And that's important because this is the driving force to make these incredibly pro-inflammatory hormones called eicosanoids that turn on all the inflammatory switches in every body. And as we have more of these omega-6 fatty acids, when they're coupled with high levels of insulin, then you have basically a surefire prescription for diet-induced inflammation. It's like adding a lighted match to a vat of gasoline. And that's what's been happening the last 40 years in America.
Well, it sounds like that's precisely the ingredient that you find in a McDonald's French fry, maybe with a shake or a Coke on the side. These are carbohydrates that are fried in refined omega-6 fatty acids, and they're highly refined. And that's just like a combustible mix that we're introducing into our bodies on a daily basis.
Well, it is. And unfortunately, those white carbohydrates, the refined carbohydrates, and the omega-6 fatty acids are the two cheapest form of calories in the world today.
Yep.
The American consumer made it very loud and clear. They say, we want cheap food that tastes great. The food companies are not evil individuals. They say, if that's what you want, we'll give it to you.
It's the marketplace.
Not knowing that they opened a Pandora's box of basically inflammation. It's once been very, very hard to close because now we're seeing inflammation spread worldwide with the globalization of these food ingredients.
Well, I think it's even worse, and I think you're aware of this, is that not only are these foods cheap, but they're artificially cheap. They're further cheapened by government subsidies that encourage the growth of corn, for example. You know, we have corn subsidies. We have subsidies for the sugar industry as if they needed it. And that further lowers the price so that all this stuff gets dumped on the marketplace in the form of cheap candy, sodas, and you know, we find sugar and fructose in virtually everything.
Well, and you're right. You know, it's our taxpayer dollars which are fueling this inflammatory epidemic that we're facing and being overwhelmed as a country.
Right. And it's our taxpayer dollars taking care of the consequences, which is the sick folks.
Well, it's a double whammy now. Your taxpayer dollars are going to make it increasing inflammation, and even more taxpayer dollars going to fight the consequences of that inflammation.
Yeah, it's a sad state of affairs. So, all right. So what, you know, coming back to the Mediterranean diet, you know, I got to say that having been to Mediterranean countries in recent times, the Mediterranean diet is a little bit of a relic. It's like the dodo bird. In fact, I think it's actually accrued the status of a World Heritage site worthy of preservation because it's virtually no longer in existence. The countries around the Mediterranean basin are being flooded with American style food, and native foods that they used to subsist on are disappearing.
Well, you're quite right. And more importantly, no one can really define the Mediterranean diet. If I was to ask you, what's the percentage of protein in the Mediterranean diet? People say, I don't know. They say, well, how much fat should you have in the Mediterranean diet? I don't know. What is the Mediterranean diet? There are 16 different countries around the Mediterranean region, and they all have very, very different diets. The one thing that seems to be universal is all those diets around the Mediterranean region, and this includes North Africa, Israel, Lebanon, and Spain, Italy, Greece, that they're very rich in fruits and vegetables. And that means they're very rich in polyphenols. And that becomes the key of why they have their longevity. The Mediterranean zone shows how you can get better benefits with those polyphenols. But the key to the Mediterranean diet is high levels of consumption of these polyphenols.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about these polyphenols, sometimes referred to as bioflavonoids. So they're of that family, correct? The terminology is somewhat equivalent. So we're talking about, obviously, the things that impart color to yellow, green, blue, orange, purple fruits and vegetables. But also polyphenols come in other forms. They come in coffee. They come in chocolate, which is one of the reasons why chocolate may be so beneficial. And they also were delivered in certain spices as well.
Well, exactly. And now we know why they're important. The most primitive part of our immune system, called the innate immune system, where all inflammation really generates from, is the same part, the same immune system that we share with plants. It's been around for hundreds of millions of years. And unlike plants, we can run from our invaders. They can't. They have to stand and fight. And their primary tool to fight microbial invaders are polyphenols.
Sometimes referred to as phytoalexins, I think. These are plant compounds which are strong antioxidants that promote survival. But I guess that has implications for whether you get a wild plant, which probably has to fight more invaders, or a hothouse tomato that is grown in a sterile environment.
This is one of the problems when we talk about conventional or organic. It's not as much about the herbicides or pesticides. It's what you're doing. You're basically making the plant weaker. If you're going to knock off all of its potential competitors, it will say, I will make less polyphenols because it takes a lot of energy, and I'll make more sugar. If you go to Italy and get wild Italian strawberries, they're incredibly small and incredibly bitter. You go to get strawberries in America, they're incredibly large and very,
right.
very sweet.
Right.
So
which pleases the palate for some people, to an unsophisticated palate, but also they're virtually devoid of taste characteristics, of character. They're sweet and it's kind of over, like on steroids almost.
Well, in many ways it is. The sweet palate aspect is one that basically is universal. We all like sweet. And polyphenols, their characteristic aspect, they're incredibly bitter. And that's why, you know, to get people to eat more fruits and vegetables, they try to basically wind down the amount of polyphenols,
right.
taking out the health benefits, and try to increase the levels of sugar to make
yep.
them more desirable. And they've done a very good job, but in the process, the level of the polyphenols we need to be able to mount appropriate challenges to maintain and control inflammation have been now brought to dangerously low levels.
Now, in your book, you do talk extensively about the polyphenols, which is a an updated finding in your writings about the zone, and you actually nail something which I think is little known, which is the polyphenols have a variety of activities. We don't even exactly know how many ways that they benefit the body. These chemicals directly affect our cellular processes, but also interestingly, the polyphenols have a major effect on our gut. On our microbiome, and it's essential to get polyphenols. That's actually one of the reasons why they think chocolate may be beneficial, not because it directly dilates the arteries or, you know, sends certain chemicals through your bloodstream, but maybe it helps create a healthy flora in your gut. And you talk about this in the book.
Well, in many ways, we're only partially human. We have some 10 trillion cells in our body. We have 100 trillion microbes in our gut. So what are we? Are we basically a microbe with a thin outer sheath of human cells? Or are we some hybrid, kind of like a transformer? Well, it doesn't matter which of the two. We have to maintain good, healthy balance of both. And that's what the polyphenols do. They act as almost a molecular gardener. They go in there and they weed out the really bad bacteria, the pathogenic ones, and basically support the growth of the very friendly bacteria. So in this regard, they might be considered nature's most powerful, probiotic. And so we have to have the constant inflow of these polyphenols to maintain a happy bacterial colony inside our gut that plays a very important role in how we function as humans.
And this is actually one of the reasons why some of the studies, they know that fiber is very beneficial. In fact, I think they came up with a study showing that people who consume a lot of vegetable and fruit fiber have dramatically reduced, like 40% reduced chance of dying, something phenomenal. But whenever they try to replicate this, so fiber is good, so then they sell you the fiber in a can, like Metamucil, it doesn't seem to work. It doesn't prevent disease. It doesn't extend longevity. So it may be that fiber, okay, there's a lot of fiber in fruits and vegetables, but you have to eat the fruits and vegetables to get the benefit, and you can't just get desiccated fiber, to act like a, Roto-Rooter in your intestinal tract.
Well, this is true. Let's take two examples. The one study that you mentioned is actually an Italian study published in 2013, looking at elderly Italians in mountain villages, somewhat isolated. So they're fairly immune to, let's say, modern food technology. What they found, that those who basically absorbed the greatest amount of polyphenols, and they measured this by looking at the levels, looked at the excreted urine.
So, which is good, because sometimes, ask people, how much did you eat yesterday? And you get very inaccurate reporting. This is better methodology, because they actually measure
much
compliance by looking at the compounds that they excrete.
And so the people who basically absorbed the most, they were living 30% longer than those mm-hmm. who basically were eating essentially the same diet, but not absorbing nearly as much.
Hmm.
Let's take an epidemiological aspect. Look at the oldest living people in the world who have legitimate birth certificates. These are the Okinawans. And the typical Okinawan meal contains about 2 pounds of vegetables every day. That's a lot of polyphenols.
Wow, 2 pounds. That's a lot of chewing.
All of a sudden, your listeners are saying, well, that sounds like Mission Impossible.
Right.
But that's why we talked about other sources of polyphenols. Spices are one. That's why America was discovered. Spices are a highly concentrated source of polyphenols. That's why they don't taste very good. But they're very powerful in preserving foods. And one spice is very, very rich in polyphenols. Turns out to be cacao, the seed we get chocolate from.
Oh, indeed. Okay.
And now no one wants to basically, no one say, oh, I love going to get my, you know, can of Hershey's Baker's chocolate and just taking 2 or 3 tablespoons out every day.
No, that'd be kind of grody.
But that's the amount you need to get significant levels of polyphenols. What we've done, we'll say, we'll add some more fat to it, we'll add some more sugar to it, and all of a sudden, it's a candy bar, and sure, it tastes a lot better, but most of the polyphenols have been destroyed in the process.
Right.
Now, why is this important? It turns out, of all people, Mars had a study in Nature magazine about 2 months ago that showed if you had high levels of these cocoa polyphenols, running about maybe about 2 grams per day, that you'd see a 25% increase in cognitive improvement within 3 months' time.
Wow.
In elderly individuals.
Well, that's good news for me because I'm a huge chocolate consumer.
Well, and so we're seeing a lot of these old wives' tales come to bear because we now have the molecular biology to basically to look at the role of these polyphenols and how they interact with our human cells and our microbial cells. And it's a fascinating communication which is unraveling and becoming more and more interesting as each day goes on.
Okay, this is a good inflection point for us to pause because we generally divide these podcasts into 2 parts. So when we return, we'll continue our discussion with today's guest, Dr. Barry Sears, famous for his Zone Diet books. He's got a new one entitled The Mediterranean Zone, and we'll discuss that in part 2 of today's Intelligent Medicine podcast. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman.